The Top 100 Project is sponsored by Sparkplug Coffee. Every coffee lover knows that the key to the best coffee is fresh roasted beans. Most coffee you buy in the grocery store or your local coffee shop was roasted months before it got to you. Sparkplug Coffee is roasted to order in Toronto and delivered right to your door anywhere in Canada while the coffee is fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug offers plenty of variety and grinds to suit any taste. Their scientific roast process ensures consistency so that each blend maintains its flavor profile. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in by going to sparkplug.coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Greetings, kids, and thanks for hearing us talk about the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the 100 most spectacular American movies. It's a Top 100 Project spoiler alert. Consider yourself amply warned. I am Ryan Ellis with my very own silent protector, my wife, Bev. That's pretty good.
Can't say anything. I'm silent.
Touché. All right, so the coming attractions trivia for this week's film, To Kill a Mockingbird. Name the 8 AFI films with animals in the title, not including the animals' names such as King Kong, Bring a Baby, Jaws. Name or nickname, I should say.
I should have thought harder about this.
One of them is not the little foxes. Our little dog Fox, as always in the summer months, is making his noise over in the corner. But he's not one of the answers.
I'm honestly drawing a blank.
Well, you say the one of them first of all.
To Kill a Mockingbird.
You got one out of eight. So here they are. Duck Soup, The Maltese Falcon. This is going chronologically, incidentally. To Kill a Mockingbird, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, The Deer Hunter, Raging Bull, Dances with Wolves, and The Silence of the Lambs.
I can't believe I didn't get Dances with Wolves. We were talking about that movie like an hour ago. Shame on me.
Deep shame on you. So the 64th Flickr show on the Top 100 Project, To Kill a Mockingbird, was 34th on AFI's 1998 Top 100, between High Noon and It Happened One Night. Then all the lawyers filed the necessary papers to ensure its rise to 25th in 2007, between E.T. and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. After a premiere on Christmas Day, 1962, Universal released Mockingbird on Valentine's Day, 1963, but we think of it as a 62 film. People loved this picture and helped make it a major success. Now, Bev will tell you what the picture is about with The Skinny.
Gregory Peck is Atticus Finch, a compassionate attorney assigned to defend a black man, Tom Robinson, played by Brock Peters, against a false rape charge. Progressive Atticus is fair with everyone, but his southern town is filled with ignorant racists. His children, Jem and Scout, come of age throughout the trial and subsequent horrendous happenings in the town.
Or in a nutshell, albinos are people too.
Creepy corner-dwelling albinos.
Robert Duvall's scariest moment of all time. Even if he was ever in a horror film, and I don't think he ever was, he could have been a great villain just standing there like he's going to murder somebody.
But we all feel bad for having prejudged him.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get to that moment later on. But what'd you think of the film?
Held by today's standards, it has some real problems. Mostly it's white savior narrative and the ridiculous perfection of Atticus Finch. And it's really worth indulging in a debate over whether or not it crosses that line and becomes condescending and naive. But I was really won over. I think the keys are seeing the whole story from Scout's perspective and Peck's incredible subtle performance.
Yeah, I think I have to agree with pretty much everything you said there.
The end. Short podcast. Well, everything Bev said. Wrapped it up.
All right, the rest of this podcast will be dead air.
Yeah. Bev just nailed it in several sentences.
While you go make your spark plug coffee. Just imagine we're talking while nothing's actually being said. No, Peck is Jesus. He has the virtues of Jesus, at least, including getting spat in the face. And he's mad. And he does wipe the spit off, but he turns the other cheek.
His perfection, it really does toe the line of being too much. But that's why I say I think it's his performance that saves it. You already mentioned Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which sits right next to it on the list. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington jumps over that line and just keeps on running. And he's so ridiculously perfect. And his performance is so over the top that it ruins it for me. And I hate that. But Peck, he's thoughtful. He really seems troubled by everything that's going on. Like you say, you know he's mad. And maybe that's why it's okay that he does the right thing always, because you know he's still struggling. You know it's not just something that comes 100% easily to him, that mm-hmm. he has to fight against his instincts to spit back in that guy's face or fight him or do 100 things that seem appropriate at the time.
A guy who's already menaced his children earlier in the film.
Yeah.
And then as we know at the end, and here's a big spoiler, he's the one that tries to kill them.
Yeah, he's dangerous. He's genuinely dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jimmy Stewart, you said, Mr. Smith, a minute ago, Jimmy Stewart could have had this role. It was too liberal for him. The more I learn about Jimmy Stewart, the real guy, the less I like. He sounds like he was a bit of a jerk. He and Henry Fonda were friends.
Yeah.
He and Henry Fonda were friends. Fonda was a strong, liberal, left-wing dude. Stewart was obviously the opposite. They agreed not to talk about politics. They could just be friends. That's a good story. I like that. But I've heard that Stewart did things like he would stalk his friends or follow them around, I guess if they were left-wing type people. And you hear about that, he doesn't want to do a movie that was certainly tailor-made for him and his acting style.
And just what part of this movie and what part of the plot did he disagree with?
Probably left-wing politics.
To be honest, you guys, I mean, white women are constantly under threat, right? Right? Am I right?
I hate to say this about a guy I like so much, but maybe that is exactly it.
Yeah.
So let's get off the Jimmy Stewart thing. Rock Hudson also could have played the role. I think he would have been good, too.
Yeah.
Not nearly as good an actor as Peck or Stewart. But he would have had that commanding father presence. And he also could be very compassionate. We talked a lot on Giant about how the movie wasn't perfect by any means. But overall, his performance was the best thing in the film. I thought so, at least.
Mm-hmm. I
could see him playing this character.
And he plays
sure.
that complex character that does despicable things, but you still like him. You can still kind of feel where he's coming from and forgive him because he evolves through the course of the film.
Yeah.
And so he
about
he
racist topics. Yes, he had been a blatant racist.
And
earlier.
He brought a lot of depth to that, something that would be hard to portray. So I could see him pulling this off maybe in the same manner that Peck did.
Well, this was Peck's favorite film of his own, too.
Mm-hmm.
He remained close with Brock Peters. Brock Peters gave the eulogy at
Peck's
Peters funeral.
Yeah, Brock Peters played Tom Robinson.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they remained friends, obviously, for about, what was that, 50 years or something? 40 years? And then Mary Badham, who played Scout, she was close to him the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he always still called her Scout, even though she was a grown-up. Peck had a really good career, and this is the only AFI movie he was ever in. He was in Roman Holiday, Guns of Navarone, Cape Fear, The Omen. I like all those titles, and I mention them because that's a great diversity of topics.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought some of the same things to The Omen that he brings to this, where he has, of course, a demon child. But bringing the Atticus Finch nobility and the gravitas worked on that film fairly well. And when he has to handle the satanic elements, he's so believable in that movie.
Mm.
Now, by no means is it nearly as important as this movie is, but I think I'd rather watch it over and over again than this one, because this one definitely is flawed. The biggest problem with this film might be what we talked about earlier tonight, and we've talked about it a lot in recent weeks because Lawrence of Arabia had some of the same things, but they made it work better in that film, I think, and that is that the white man, the white people in this case, are telling the story of African Americans who are props in some ways, not as bad as they are in some movies, but they're sort of props in their own story.
Yeah, I'd like to say, by today's standards, you judge it far more harshly. I think in the 60s this probably was...
Because they were breaking down that door very slowly.
They were
tapping down that door.
Yeah, and it really is, when Harper Lee wrote the book, she is Scout. She grew up in this family. Her father was an attorney. Her mother wasn't dead, but distant. I think she had a brother as well. Like, there's all kinds of...
She based Atticus on her own father.
Yes.
Her mother's maiden name was Finch. And then her friend, Truman Capote, her actual friend, is the basis for Dill.
Yeah, she had a black housekeeper as well that helped look after them. This is the story that gets made because Hollywood will make this story. The reason why people criticize the white savior story is because it is all there seems to be. Whereas in the 60s when this came out, I don't even think that there was a lot to compete with this. If you look up savior, and they have like a list of films in Wikipedia of what is considered white savior films... Do you know what the earliest two examples are? To Kill a Mockingbird and Lawrence of Arabia.
No.
Nothing from before the 60s.
Wow, really?
So this was actually, at the time, something of a progressive film, as it was a progressive book.
I think it stands up as a progressive film, looking back at it. It wouldn't be if they wrote it right now. But then she, Harper Lee, and the filmmakers are also showing what these people were like in the 30s.
Yes.
Because the film is set in 1932 in a made-up town called Macomb in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And like a future Alabaman character, Forrest Gump, also in a made-up town called Greenbow, he befriends blacks without really necessarily dwelling on the fact that they're not the same as him. Although I guess Atticus doesn't befriend them, but he certainly just mingles with them, and he, of course he represents Robinson.
And Scout and Jem do. You know, they don't seem to think twice about...
When they're brought up to the top level of the courthouse?
They just hang out with them. Mm. It's not really a big deal. They mind Calpurnia without a second thought. They don't treat her with any disrespect. And she doesn't seem shy about disciplining them,
even when
Atticus
is
there. Yeah. And disciplining her about being rude to somebody because he's poor. Or he's a guest. And he does something that she doesn't approve of. He puts syrup on his food. And this is a detail that they made a point of including in the film when you're not altogether sure why. They could have probably shortened Walter's storyline a lot more and still had it tie in to the mob scene when she dissuades Walter's father from lynching Tom Robinson. But they include that disciplinary action of Calpurnia because it's important that you see Calpurnia's relationship to the children, that she has that level of authority. And in that household, they get taught the lesson of treating everybody equally and treating people who are your guests with respect, no matter who they are.
And Calpurnia is not their mother, and she never will be. But she clearly has more influence than the average maid in the average movie does. Mm-hmm. And she seems to be in their life in a constant kind of way. She's always there. And Peck, often in the film, is leaving at night to go take care of his job. It's not like he's going out to get drunk or he's going out to hang with his friends.
Mm-hmm.
He has to deal with things in the middle of the night. So a few times the kids are left alone. And of course, they get into some of the trouble they do when they're left alone.
Mm-hmm.
But you get the feeling that he can just say, okay, well, the neighbor might watch the kids, the female friend, or of course, Calpurnia. And he's fine with that. Which is nice to see, too. It'd be tough to be a widower or a widow, a man raising a family in the 30s by yourself, in the Depression, in a small town like that, where you have a job like he had. We talked about one of the problems with the film is the progression of time.
Yeah, they really handle it poorly. It takes place over the course of 3 years, but it's hard to tell how
nothing
much time
really
is passing.
Seems to
change. We kind of had to keep reminding ourselves, yeah, nothing seems to change. Their outfits don't even change.
The kids aren't going to age, and that's one of those things where people dwell on that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
like,
but
if they ever dwell on a kid doesn't look like a parent in a movie, well, of course they don't. They're not that actor's son or daughter, but they should look somewhat different, and you're right, they don't really look.
Let her hair grow out a little, change their outfit at the very least, and Dill, that was the thing, he comes back the next summer, and he's wearing the exact same outfit.
Maybe it's implying that he's poor, and that's the best he can do. But then it maybe should look more worn out, dirty, like it'd been worn for a full year.
Mm-hmm. Or at least make the pants shorter or something. They're going to get
that would be
they're
a good
way.
Yeah.
Their, I imagine that Scout probably was wearing her brother's hand-me-downs because she dressed like a boy anyway.
Yeah.
So you could make her wear the overalls that Jem was wearing the summer before.
Clothes are a great way to hide anything with a movie character. We've heard it before where actresses are pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Far From Heaven, Julianne Moore is pregnant through, I think, the entire filming. But you never know it because of the way that they dressed her.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with this. You can make outfits seem bigger or smaller. Give her floods.
Yeah, yeah.
And because
they are kind of floods, the pants that she's wearing through the entire film. But at any rate, they could
make
have
them
made
more flooded.
Some, yeah, they could have made some effort to just have the kids change a little bit over the years. Her hair grows something.
Yeah. I think one of the problems I had with this film the first time I saw it, which was a long time ago, and I remember not being a big fan of this movie. I don't know why this bothered me so much, but it always irritated me that the two kids, and I remembered it being more Scout than Jem, always calling him Atticus.
Yeah.
But then she does say early on in the film to Walter's father when he comes to bring the, was it walnuts or something?
Yeah, something
payment
like that.
For the court fees that he can't actually pay with money. And she says something about how that's what he wants. That's what Atticus says to them. It just kind of got under my skin.
It's definitely strange.
But seeing the movie this time, both kids and Dill as well, at least in the movie a lot less, they're good young actors, especially for 1960s type acting. We've seen some bad child acting in the early part of this project, for sure. It was probably just done that way. That's just the way they were directed. That's just the way kids maybe actually were in reality. But it wasn't very believable. Certainly doesn't hold up. That's one of the worst things from old films, I think, is some of that golly gee style from kid actors. But these ones don't have that. And Mary Badham is terrific. She was nominated for the Supporting Actress Oscar. She lost it to a fellow child actor, Patty Duke.
No kidding.
She was in The Miracle Worker.
Oh, wow.
And she only made 3 other films. She's still going. She's 62 years old, still alive. She made a couple of TV guest spots and all that time in those other 3 films, and that's about it. The actor who played her brother, Philip Alford, was only in Shenandoah with Jimmy Stewart. We said him already, and here he comes up again.
Yeah, okay.
And also did some TV guest spots. So these two actors were pretty good from their youth,
yeah.
But didn't really stick with it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I didn't really like her performance for the first time I saw it, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I certainly bought into it more this time.
I love Scout. I loved her from the book. It's so rare you see a film made from the perspective of a little girl at all.
Mm-hmm.
But she's not just any little girl. She's this unique, fully realized character. Something you don't see a lot of in movies. She's such a tomboy, and she's just so bright and precocious. And I think it's her child's perspective that really saves the story from becoming kind of a boring morality tale. Although it definitely is more successful doing that in the first half of the film than the second half of the film. The second half of the film, it kind of falls apart. As soon as they go into that courtroom, and I know this is the most famous scene and people are crazy about it, but to me that's when the film kind of slows down and becomes a little dull. Maybe because I know it so well and because it's kind of something that's been played out and homaged or copied so many times that it feels a little trite. I don't know. Maybe not trite. Maybe that's the wrong word.
I would say that the scenes after the trial are not as good.
Oh, yeah. Sure. I agree in that.
That's like part of the problem with the time jump. Mm-hmm. Because what happens to Tom, first he's railroaded in the court case, and then we get this completely BS story about how he tried to run away. Which another movie I'm going to compare here to. There's a lot of movies I'm going to bring up in this podcast. We've mentioned a few already. Here's another one. The Shawshank Redemption. Mm-hmm. Spoiler for this movie. I usually say it too late, but I'll say this time. When Tommy, Gil Bellows' character, comes in and he agrees to testify in favor of Andy Dufresne. Mm-hmm. And the warden, when he finds that out, has him gunned down. But then he goes to Andy. The warden does and says, "For shame, the young boy trying to run away and so young." And nearly at the end of his sentence, it broke Captain Hadley's heart to have to shoot him. Which we know is not true because we saw it actually happen. Yeah. And Andy's going to know it isn't true. We don't see what happens with Tom, but we know it's pretty much the same crap story.
It's ridiculous, the notion that anybody would even, for a second, entertain the story as it's presented to them. Mm-hmm. That he ran away.
And the deputy trying to wing him or stop him, maybe shoot him in the leg, hits him mortally. Either the head or the heart, I guess.
Oops, I guess I murdered that guy I've wanted to kill for the past year.
And here's a question, by the way, about that. Let's say the trial had gone the way it should have, and Tom wasn't found guilty. Would they maybe have strung him up anyway? The lynch mob that tried to get him earlier in the film, at some point when he goes back to his life again, gets tracked down, a bunch of guys in some pickup truck, and the next thing the story gets out there, "Hey, Tom Robinson died today. Why?" Eh, no reason.
I mean, even though he's killed, Bob Ewell is still so mad about being humiliated in court that he wants to kill Atticus's children. You think he wouldn't have lynched Tom Robinson? Of course he would have. Yeah, you're absolutely right. That guy was doomed no matter what.
And speaking of the lynch mob, let's go back to that scene earlier in the film. That's a very famous part of this movie, too. There's three or four, maybe more, truly red-letter moments for a lot of people. That's probably one reason why this movie rose on the list the way it did, to the top 25. When Scout and Jem and Dill bust into that, they essentially save Atticus's life, because you get the feeling that he'll risk his life to do the right thing yet again, and that's to protect Tom from being lynched by these guys. So the kids smooth the situation over, and what Scout does is so smart because she guilts this guy. And as people have pointed out in some of the reviews I've read, there's a shot of her. It's not over the top. It's not a zoom in on her eyeballs where it's, "I know what I'm doing." But if you look even remotely close, you can see she's doing this without being the innocent child. She is an innocent child, but she's being kind of a woman in this moment saying, "How can I fix this situation?" "Oh, yeah, your son, Walter. Yeah, your son. You have a kid, don't you? What are you doing out here with these guys to come murder somebody?" Which isn't said, but that's implied. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of them get guilted too. Again, it could be that they would come back later that night or some other night to take care of Tom. But okay, the scene works. We'll grant the fact that these kids defuse this violent situation. And that's part of her performance that works so well too. She doesn't oversell that moment. It isn't overdirected or overwritten. But if you look into it, you can see that this isn't just her stumbling across a good luck thing that she makes them back down. She does it on purpose.
That being said, one of the rare dissenters is Roger Ebert, who doesn't give it a terrible review. It's unusual for him to dislike a film like this at all, but
racial films, he was a big proponent of promoting it, maybe because he married a black woman.
But one of his criticisms was of that scene in particular, this knowing look that she gives, that she's intentionally dissuading this lynch mob, and he points out what is true, which is a girl her age, that's ridiculously idealistic to attribute that kind of
courage. So she wouldn't have those kind of skills.
She wouldn't be that good at it. She wouldn't have that manipulative skill. And she wouldn't have the courage to stand up to a lynch mob like that. Because no child her age would. And that's kind of where they go over the top with the idea.
I don't agree with the last part of that she wouldn't have the courage, because her brother does first. Her brother and Dill and her, the three of them run up there. But the first person to speak of the three kids, as I recall, is Jem, who's defying his father, and for the right reasons. Atticus tells him to go home. "Jem, take your sister and Dill and go home." "No, sir." And he refuses, I think, three different times. He's 10 years old. I can see a kid being willful enough to defy his father, and then Scout just follows his lead.
Yeah, maybe. I really am on the fence about that, because even though it may be unrealistic, it still is kind of this lovely thing to indulge in, that these kids have a father that's that great, that they would actually have the gumption to stand up like that. It's a nice thing to believe, and for some reason, this film, I just forgive it.
Well, one thing about him that I said during the movie was he's kind of like Dirty Harry. He has nothing to do with the actual Dirty Harry, the Clint Eastwood character we know, the cop character who had five movies made about him. except for the line he has in the original Dirty Harry movie, where they ask him why he's called that, and he says, "Every dirty job." And that's what Peck has to do in this movie. He's got to kill the dog that no one else can shoot from a distance, and he has to fumble with his glasses to do it, and he's got to take care of Tom. He's the only person apparently that can do that and risks his life just by representing him, obviously, and then his kids have their lives put in danger later. And when he goes to the courthouse steps with his book and his lamp, he has to know that violence is extremely possible. That's why he's going there.
He's even inexplicably given the task of telling Tom's widow what happened to him.
Right.
It's true. He does get every dirty job, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. Poor Atticus.
Well, you mentioned Ebert. We've talked about him on so many of our podcasts. And one little plug, just recently we both saw, separately, Life Itself.
The documentary.
So this has nothing to do with To Kill a Mockingbird, but a bit of a plug in the middle of the podcast. Really good documentary, emotional at times. They left out some things I wish they'd put in there. Richard Roper, who did the show with him for quite a long time, too. Obviously, Siskel was by far his biggest co-star. Roper's not really even mentioned. He's certainly not in the movie. But still, there's a lot of great stuff in that, and it was great to see. And we've talked about Ebert so often in our podcast, so here's a plug for the movie about him.
Yeah, since we're on an aside about Roger Ebert, before we started the project and I didn't really aggressively seek out film reviews, I don't think I realized he's such a great writer. Mm-hmm. Like, he really is my absolute favorite film reviewer now. So that's it. I'll finish that plug for Roger.
Well, one of the reasons we mention him so often is because he has reviewed so many older movies. Now, when we get into the modern films, the 80s, the 90s, and the one film from the 2000s, which would be Lord of the Rings, which is the last film we'll cover on this, there's a lot of reviews out there. There's dozens you could mention by hundreds, I guess, in total. But there's probably at least a dozen by pretty reputable critics with those newer films. But the older ones, generally, you're not going to find a lot. You're going to see the Bosley crowd. There's occasionally
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Pauline Kael.
Yeah. She doesn't get a link on IMDb, though, so I can never find her reviews. I probably would look at those more often. I know that she could be cynical.
Definitely harder to come by,
yeah. And she could be cynical and mean in her reviews, which would be an interesting take on some of these movies that everyone else reveres. It wouldn't shock me if she dislikes a movie that everybody else likes. But then again, is this movie, kind of like Lawrence, review-proof? Who wants to be the jerk dissenter against To Kill a Mockingbird? Because even Ebert was couching what he was saying. The 2.5-star review, didn't rave about it, had a lot of issues with it. Reading that review, I thought he was at least a fan. I looked right past the star rating. You had to remind me about it. So 94% of Rotten Tomatoes critics are fans, 93% of audiences. Those That's are damn good numbers for a movie that absolutely has a ton of flaws.
Isn't it in the top 50 for IMDb fan favorite films?
It's in the top 80. Right now it's 78th, which is still pretty respectable.
Yeah, it's still pretty respectable.
A lot of the movies that are absolutely revered by the AFI are nowhere near the top 50 or even in the top 250
in some cases. And not a ton of older films are in the top 100 either, right?
It's a fair amount, actually. Yeah. It's a pretty good diversity. That's one of the things I like about the IMDb's 250, because anybody can vote. And yeah, there's going to be people who will stuff that ballot box, but anybody in the world can vote on that if they want to. And then, of course, you get foreign films in there, too. Mm-hmm. And it isn't just the stereotypical Citizen Kane, Gone with the Wind, Casablanca answers. None of those three are even in the top 10. Or maybe Kane is, but the other ones are not. Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about the most famous thing in this whole movie, the one-day trial.
Which takes, like, a year to lead up to it, as I can tell. He gets asked to do the trial, and then it's not till the
following
summer.
A full summer has passed, yeah.
Yeah. That's weird, too. And they never really explain
it. It seems to be that the trial itself takes place in one day. Now, they don't have a lot of witnesses. But we all know from a modern trial that it's at least days and probably weeks, especially something as serious as a rape or had it been a murder or something.
Where his life is on the line, he would be sentenced to death.
Look how long OJ's trial lasted and the lead up to it. But then again, the lead up might not have been as long as the lead up in this, fictional though it may be.
The courtroom scene is a great example of why people criticize this film for the white savior syndrome, because the conclusion is heartbreaking, but no focus is put on the individual who's really suffering, which is Tom Robinson. They read the verdict, you kind of see Tom's reaction, and then he's shuffled out of the court, and then we hold on Atticus's reaction. It's all about him. It's not really about the true victim of what happened.
It's interesting, too, that when Tom walks out, Atticus walks up and says, "I expected this to happen here," implying that they're going to appeal, and they'll do it somewhere else, maybe as far as the Supreme Court, wherever far it has to go. Atticus seems very confident that they're going to be able to beat this when they get a more fair court, trial, jury, all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. But Tom doesn't say anything. And he doesn't also have some teary moment. He doesn't have some look of anger. He's almost three-quarter profile. You see the side of his head. Yeah. He looks at Atticus, walks away. And we never see him again because
his performance
he
feels
dies
like
that night.
Really quite realistic. Like, he seems to be in shock and just overcome with grief of what's happening to him.
Apparently when he breaks down on the stand and starts crying, it's, "Did you rape Mayella Ewell?" "I did not, sir." And when he's crying, Peck had to look away. He had to look right past him, even though usually actors want to look into each other's eyes, but he couldn't look at him. He would have broken down too, he said.
Yeah.
And then Peck has that summation speech at the end in one take. the camera follows him around. I love the way they do that too, because when he walks one way, you can see Tom sitting down and the various people. Well, actually, behind them would be Mayella and her father, Bob.
So and they're in the
shop. Actual villain, the other victim, the poor girl who's been beaten. And the movie doesn't make it clear that she was raped by her father, but you said the book does.
When I read the book, I didn't get that. It would have been very subtle, the insinuation that her father... I don't remember.
I guess the point is that he's at least beating her. That's bad enough.
Oh, he's definitely beating her.
So the second victim in this entire story. And then as Atticus walks around, the judge and the bailiff are seen. But there have been so many, there's probably hundreds at this point, but at least dozens of really well-known famous ones, of lawyers giving summation scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Costner and JFK. Paul Newman in The Verdict, one of the better ones for sure. And I can go on and on about this.
Denzel Washington. Time to Kill. That's sure, a great one,
And other movies, McConaughey's been a good lawyer in movies. He always played a good lawyer. Denzel Washington in Philadelphia. Not so much the summation, but when he badgers his own witness, that's one of the great scenes in that film. But this is a classic example of how the movie is about racism, abject racism, a topic we've had on this project more than once, although not so much lately. We're going to get it more when we get later into the 60s, 67. We've got two movies that are completely about racism and the way people handle it,
the
right ways and the wrong ways. But the movie probably wouldn't have been made had it been that the blacks are more center stage than they probably should be. This is their story, but it is how the Finches, Atticus and the kids, deal with it and handle it.
Yeah, and the movie will get made if it's about the Finches rather than the Robinsons, and that's the complaint about the white savior.
Because you cast Gregory Peck or had that cast Hudson or Jimmy Stewart, that's how the movie gets made in the first place, about a tough topic. Despite the Pulitzer Prize credentials of the book that was only released a few years before this movie, another example of a classic book. It became a classic movie that was a very short turnaround. Gone with the Wind and Grapes of Wrath are two others. But let's come to the moment that I told you that it was going to just destroy me, because I've seen it in clips many times. And that is the line that should have been a top 100 quote. How in the world it wasn't, I don't know. It's when the pastor who's invited the kids up with him, he only has a few lines in the whole movie when he first takes up Jem and Scout and Dill into the upper level of the court with him. And then at the end, it's, Miss Jean Louise, stand up. Your father's passing. Lawrence Fishburne and Burt Reynolds talk about that in the two AFI specials. Reynolds, the first one in 98, and Fishburne in 2007. There's a longer piece from Fishburne actually online I found, and he actually does go on longer and more detail. It's a movie that really gets to him for obvious reasons. He talks about how that kills him. It always killed me too, but I actually watched the scene before we watched the movie a few times to kind of rev myself to get used to it, to clean my pipe, so to speak. So it didn't kill me quite as much, but it still just kills me because of how much respect they're showing this guy who tried his best and failed. But again, let's look at it from Atticus' point of view, because this is the one scene that isn't from Atticus' point of view, because it is about all the blacks who slowly stand to pay him that tribute. No one else is even in the courtroom anymore. There's a few people in the doorway, and Atticus is cleaning up his stuff.
Yeah, it's strange how the, and this is kind of a flaw in the film, like how all the white people just politely file out. There's no ruckus about the conviction at all. And all the black people in the upper part of the courtroom calmly pay their respects.
What else are they going to do?
Well, that
they would get probably put in jail and maybe even killed.
Well, that's true. That's true. And like them behaving themselves and behaving with as much dignity as they do, I understand why that's like a necessary detail in the film. But the fact that that verdict is read and no emotion is really expressed except for this tiny bit from Tom Robinson and Atticus's kind of distress. All the emotion in that courtroom is so muted. It's a little strange.
I wonder if they knew the result was going to be what it was and they were so unsurprised.
Yeah.
But again, from Atticus's point of view, sorry to do that because we said before that's a bit of a flaw. Why doesn't he react more? He doesn't ever, again, doesn't get a close-up. You don't see him look up at them and do that kind of like the Dead Poets Society thing. Thank you, boys. Thank you. Where they pay tribute at the end of that movie to Rob Williams' character. But there are two reasons why. One is because, as I said, he's going to appeal. For him, this isn't over.
Yeah.
Why get emotional about this? This isn't over yet. And the second part of it is that he probably thinks, at least so far, I failed you. I don't deserve that.
Yeah, he's not proud of what he did because he didn't succeed. Even though he says he knew that that's how it would happen, you know he was hoping that they would acquit him.
Especially when Mayella on the stand even contradicts her own story about remembering what happened. She says something like she doesn't remember that. Oh, but no, it really was like that. You'd think that right there would sink the case. But it doesn't matter. It was a stacked up all along.
Another reason why this film would be controversial, far more controversial today than it was in the 60s, would be the treatment of Mayella. And even that the main storyline is a woman making up a rape accusation, falsely accusing a man of rape. I think that the public is so sensitive about that right now. And then the way she's treated on the stand is not really all that kind, even though everybody kind of universally agrees that she's a victim. She goes through hell.
Yeah. Colin Wilcox Paxton, I guess she was actually billed as Colin Wilcox in this film, is the one who plays her. she had a pretty good career, and she really only has that one bit of dialogue when she's on the stand. She really doesn't speak otherwise. Mm-hmm. She's the poor victim sitting beside her father. You wonder if she's been Stockholm syndromed to the point where she actually does believe that Tom really did these things, even though he didn't do any of them. And here's another reference I want to make to a movie and a book before that, a book I read when I was young and really liked it. Everyone else loves Catcher in the Rye, and I think that's a great book too. But a book called That Was Then, This Is Now, which Emilio Estevez directed a few years after it came out. Similar kind of thing where the main character defends a black woman against some other toughs, as I believe is the way the story goes. And it's mistaken that he was doing something to her. And when the black woman's brother, I think it is, and friends come along, what happened and who did this or something like that? And she looks at the guy who's trying to help her and says, kill him. And then the line of the book is, and they almost did. And that, of course, is heartbreaking because not only is it bad that he had to go through that, but he was trying to help. And that's what happens in this movie. Tom was completely innocent. It wasn't like he was just a neutral character. He was trying to help her break some wood or something. Like
the chifarobe.
Yeah, something like that.
I don't know what a chifarobe is.
And then she comes on to him. So it's bad enough that he's victimized, but he's trying to do a nice thing.
She planned that, though. Like, she deliberately sent the kids out for ice cream and developed this friendship with Tom and planned to try to seduce him. So it doesn't seem likely to me that she could turn around and believe her lies, considering how much forethought went into all that happening.
So maybe she's more of a villain than...
She's certainly far from innocent.
No,
but she's also obviously terrified of her maniac father.
Yeah. So we talked so much about Brock Peters, who's only in the courtroom scenes, essentially. I don't think we see him really otherwise. And he's, again, only one AFI film. He also was in Porgy and Bess, a movie I can't seem to find anywhere. It's the only nominated film for the two lists I've never seen, because I can't seem to find it. I tried to download it, it looks like crap. He was also in Soylent Green, It's Made of People! And he was in several Star Trek movies as Admiral Cartwright. So what did you think of him and the various other actors who played the unfortunate pawns in their own story, the Calpurnias of the world, and the various other black characters who don't really get a chance to be mad like they have a right to be about what's happening anyway in this town, and then what happens to Tom?
It made me think a little bit of Manchurian Candidate, because even though it's a film that's about race, whereas Manchurian Candidate just casts black people in everyday roles without calling attention to it, but it made me think of it simply because they are realized characters played by competent actors, and you feel like they have a personality and something beyond, even though they're both kind of servile characters, but that's realistic. Calpurnia feels real. She feels like she has depth. Tom, definitely, his performance is heartbreaking when he's sitting there and he's testifying and he's sweating and he's trying to keep his composure. And then that second when he says he feels sorry for Mayella and then immediately realizes what a wrong thing that was to say
that
to win over
with
the
much
jury. Yeah, it's kind of implied that that is the moment that he did himself in.
Mm-hmm.
But he realizes that as soon as he says it out loud. It's a beautiful performance. It's strange that you don't see him before then, even though it makes sense. And from Scout's perspective, it definitely makes sense.
Yeah.
But to introduce his character and see it so realized as you do in that one short scene, I think it says a lot about him as an actor. And they both, him and Calpurnia, they're dignified, you know?
Yeah, they're not playing mammy. They're not the...
Yeah,
yes, sir. No, sir.
It also doesn't feel like overkill. It feels kind of realistic. The film has been criticized for the way Tom's family was portrayed. They have no lines.
Very briefly, when he goes to tell them what happened, he speaks to the father, who doesn't know Tom's dead yet.
Yeah. His widow has no line. They seem to just kind of be there, and they're watching. I mean, Bob Ewell comes right into their yard.
Twice in the movie.
Yeah, and they do nothing. They just kind of stand there and put up with it. And I understand that's the position that they're in, but it seems a little propish, I think is one of them.
But you hit on it a minute ago, and this movie has everything from the point of view of the kids. I don't know, maybe not every single moment, but just about every single moment is from the point of view of Scout especially, because it's even narrated by that character, the grown-up version of Scout, which I guess suggests right there that the scene at the end, which we'll talk about in a second, she obviously doesn't die if she's narrating the story when she's a grown woman. But maybe that's why. We can't see how they react because she's not in the house with them. And she's not in their community, except in the scenes when she and Atticus are there briefly. And they're probably going to be deferential to him, even if they realize he's one of the good ones, because he's still a white man with power and a physically big white man. And obviously a powerful man in the community because they know he's a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe there's a certain amount of fear, even for somebody that they would come to realize they can respect.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those movies, too. You wonder what would happen in the next year Is Atticus even more respected by everybody in the community? Or does he have even more trouble? Does he have more to worry about from the racists?
Well, yeah, you get the impression, like we said, if Tom Robinson had been acquitted, he would have been lynched.
Yeah.
Bob Ewell's reaction to this was to try and murder Atticus's children. This is going to spur more violence on. This is Depression-era Alabama.
Right.
These people are angry, and they're not...
In their opinion, the blacks aren't even people anyway.
No, I know.
So let's talk about the ending, because that's where we finally see one of the biggest names to come out of this movie. Probably the biggest name to come out of this movie, even though it was his debut, and that's Robert Duvall, who plays the infamous Boo Radley. He is the Booist ex machina, I guess, the Deus ex machina. They talk about him all through the movie, and we finally see him at the end. We're going to put a picture of this on the website, where it looks like a horror film moment when he's behind the door. There he is! He's behind the door, Atticus! And of course, Atticus would have known he's back there the whole time.
It's so creepiest thing ever.
Did you kind of jump when we saw that moment? Like it was a horror film moment?
I don't think it made me jump, but I remember exclaiming how totally...
I know what
creepy
it was.
You know what it was?
You said, Jesus!
He just comes out and he's creeping in the corner in the shadows, just sitting there watching the children.
And has been there for hours, probably.
Yes, it's so creepy! Yeah. Why doesn't anybody call attention to this? The whole Boo Radley part is the part that works the least.
I agree with you on that, yeah.
Yeah.
Why was he out there stalking the Finch kids, and why was he carrying a kitchen knife?
I think Bob Ewell was supposed to be the one with the kitchen knife, and they turned it on him. That he took Bob Ewell's weapon.
Although, why does Ewell need a knife against two little kids? But okay, fine. I'll give you that one. But why was Boo stalking them?
It's creepy.
Or following them.
Yeah, him carrying Jem's limp body is creepy enough, to carrying his body to the house. And then even creepier is Scout's reaction, where she doesn't react at all. There's this man that I've been scared of my whole childhood.
Absolutely terrified.
He's creeping behind a door, and he's been there this whole time, and I didn't realize it. Oh, that's the man that put a knife in Bob Ewell's guts. That one right there. Like, he should, by all means, be covered in blood in some way.
Right, yeah.
And there's also kind of a disconnect with the way that the sheriff...
Frank Overton plays Heck Tate.
Yeah, Heck Tate and Atticus quickly and without too much discussion agree to not pursue justice in this case and not let anybody know what happened and just pretend that Bob Ewell fell in his own knife, you know, as one does. And it's that kind of lack of acknowledgement that they're agreeing to commit what is a grievous crime, and they're so casual about it, even after they've spent the whole movie pursuing justice. And I'm not saying it would be unjust to let Boo Radley get away with killing Bob Ewell. It kind of is justice in the karmic sense, but not in these people whose jobs that they passionately do, their jobs are to keep the law. So for them to just be like, let's just let this one lie, and even though my children are witnessing me break the law, I'm totally cool with it and don't feel like it deserves any more explanation than that.
Sheriff Heck even says about how the universe balances out, because the man who was essentially killed by Bob Ewell, not literally, Tom Robinson, is dead, and now he's dead, and this other guy who had nothing to do with anything is the one who killed him, so it all evens out. Okay, I guess it does. Like you said, karmically, that's a good word for it. But it is sort of bizarre ending. Yeah, it's one of those, if you really want to look right deep into it, I think that seems wrong.
And isn't anybody troubled about this kid, this weirdo who lives in a basement and only emerged for one night when he just happens to have killed a man?
No, he's been out many times. They make that pretty clear. He's putting things in the tree for the kids to find.
Oh, so creepy.
And he also
totally creepy.
Well, while they're on their
soap dolls that look like them.
When he's on, when they're, I should say, on his porch, and they see the shadow of him. We never see him, but they do. Another thing that's interesting is that Jem describes him as being so scary. He actually makes him sound like Sloth in the Goonies, the way he describes him to Dill.
Yeah.
But of course, that's a 10-year-old. Kids do that all the time. But they would have seen him. They're all hiding their faces, but they would at least see what he basically looks like. They shouldn't be so terrified of him. He's not nearly as tall or as scary as he's put out to be, but he is an albino, so he looks a little weird. I don't think Robert Duvall was anything close to too pale, because it was just a bunch of makeup and blonde hair.
Yeah.
It's black and white, too, of course. This movie is not a color film, so you get the feeling that he's what they say he is about being this... He doesn't even look that weird, though. He doesn't look that terrifying, except in that one shot.
Yeah.
Where I don't know if he's necessarily supposed to be that terrifying. It's probably so supposed scary. To be, oh, Jem's savior is there. But he looks like he might murder them all right then and there.
You crack me up when you just did, like, a quick Sling Blade impression.
Because, yeah, they're all on the porch by that point, and then Duvall looks through the window, and then Jem, the way he bends down, is, it's a French fried bear.
I wonder if Billy Bob Thornton's character in Sling Blade was fashioned after Boo Radley.
Duvall,
he dresses like him.
Duvall and Thornton were friends. They were both in each other's movies they directed. Duvall is the father that we see in Sling Blade.
Oh, well,
he plays Billy Bob Thornton's character's father. And then Thornton has a role in Duvall's movie the next year, The Apostle, that he directed.
It so must be intentional.
It must have
Chalk
been.
That up to the influence section yeah. of films that were influenced
Even
by
the way that Boo is dressed is sling blade ass.
Very much, yeah, yeah.
Well, and speaking of Robert Duvall, he has got the most AFI movies of anybody who's not Ward Bond as an actor. Ward Bond, of course, was always a supporting player. Duvall was a supporting player, but a very important supporting player. This is his debut movie, period, in his first AFI movie, obviously. He's in MASH, which we'll get to at the end of the year. He's in the two Godfather films,
yeah, of course.
Which is a critical supporting mm-hmm. performance in both films. And in fact, Tom Hanks says that he thinks Duvall is the best thing in the first movie, of the three brothers, at least. Four, I guess, including John Cazale. And then he's in Nashville, which was the year after Godfather Part 2. I can't wait until we watch that next year. We get the Blu-ray. I haven't seen it in so long, and you never have. One of the great movies in the 70s. And his most famous supporting performance is in Apocalypse Now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a hell of a resume right there, just with AFI films, let alone the other films he did. So he's the albino. He's the pure white character. But getting back to the black characters for a minute, it's really jarring when Scout uses the N-word. He's a six-year-old that's saying this word. She's quoting somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And then Peck uses it as well to say, don't say the N-word, Scout. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you can see the look on his face, like that dignified look he shows so much in this movie. Did you agree that when you hear her say that, it's a word that can be jarring. We hear it so often in life. We hear it so often in movies. We're going to hear it a ton in Pulp Fiction and some other movies yeah. in the 90s.
It's one of the few words I can't say out loud.
Well, I've addressed what the word is. But
yeah, yeah, but
I do feel weird saying it. If I were to ever say it, it'd be to quote, say, a Pulp Fiction or a movie that uses it too much, honestly. But if I ever hear myself saying it, even quoting those movies, I feel wrong in saying that.
Yeah, and you're right, having it come from a six-year-old's mouth, and she's quoting somebody else, mm-hmm. and she's saying with that kind of innocence of somebody directing it right to her father and accepting his lesson that it's a word she should never use.
It may be movies like this, actually, that got people to start realizing just how bad that is. And there are still tons of people out there, especially in America, especially in the South of America, that will say it and mean it the way that they always did.
Yeah, yeah.
But the rest of us, I think for the most part, do have that white liberal guilt that we probably should have about saying a word that's meant so derogatorily.
Mm.
So, anyway.
This film indulges in some good white liberal guilt, doesn't it?
We deserved it. We still do.
Yeah, absolutely. It preys right on my white guilt bone.
Well, speaking of liberals, and we talked about him already earlier in the podcast, but Henry Fonda, this movie needed him in the worst way in that jury room.
I said that when the jury goes off.
I had written that note about 2 minutes before, and you said the exact same line. And I'll add this, they also needed Joseph Sweeney, who plays the old man in 12
yep.
Angry Men,
yep.
to stand up, because if that one guy, so I won't stand against the rest of you if you want to find the guy guilty, and then it's Sweeney who keeps the movie going in 12 Angry Men. In a way, he's the secondary hero, but he's also a pretty important hero in that movie. And this movie needed them both.
Unfortunately, in Macomb, Alabama, there's no jurors 8 and 9.
I guess not, yeah. It's a bunch of white guys, just like in 12 Angry
yeah.
Men, though.
Oh, yeah.
No women and no non-whites.
They weren't allowed to serve in juries in the 30s. Because of Jim Crow laws.
Of course, right, sure.
Yeah.
So the film was a critical success at the time, financial success at the time, made its money back, and then some. It wasn't the hit that Lawrence of Arabia and West Side Story were, the ones we've recently covered, or some of the ones that are coming soon, Sound of Music, My Fair Lady. All these movies are massive hits all time. But like Lawrence of Arabia, it probably shouldn't have succeeded because there's no love interest. There's no clear villain. At least not until the end of the movie in this one with Bob Ewell. We don't really know for sure what he's been doing until the end. And there's not much action. Lawrence also didn't have the benefit of having big stars. This one has Gregory Peck, who certainly was a big name.
It had the advantage of the book, which was massively popular.
Yeah.
It was a sensation.
And coming off the heels of it, as I said, only a couple years later.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't wait mm-hmm. too long to make it into a film from being this popular Pulitzer Prize winning book. We haven't talked about the director yet, and we certainly usually mention this person by now, but here we are way into the podcast, maybe because he's so subtle in this movie, and he's not a big name in the history of Hollywood, Robert Mulligan, first journeyman director who isn't kind of a star we've had in a little while, I would mm-hmm. say. We've had so much Hitchcock, Wilder, and some of those big-name directors. We just recently had Kubrick. This is his only AFI film. He also did Fear Strikes Out, a pretty good baseball movie with Anthony Perkins, and Summer of 42. He's one of those, like I said, journeyman guys who worked a lot, and Alan J. Pakula, the producer, produced six of Mulligan's films. One of them was Fear Strikes Out. The adapter of Lee's book is Horton Foote, and he also wrote Tender Mercies for Duvall, actually. That was Duvall's Oscar-winning performance in 83, and The Trip to Bountiful, which won an Oscar for Geraldine Fitzgerald, I think, or Geraldine Page. I forget her name now. I'll go with Geraldine Page. We talked a lot earlier about Harper Lee. One more thing I want to add about her is there's a recent article on Slate, and I suggest you go read it, because she was a complicated person. She's gotten quite a bit older. Go find it on Slate.com,
oh, okay.
The article about Harper Lee. And the producer, Alan J. Pakula, who directed AFI films All the President's Men and Sophie's Choice way into our future.
Hmm.
So we're going to talk about him later, but as a director. I think maybe as a producer too, but certainly as a director first and foremost. Mulligan cinematographer Russell Harlan, who Gregory Peck mentioned in his Oscar speech. I actually watched that a few days ago. Mm. He was very, not surprisingly, dignified and gracious. He mentioned many people by name. Not the kids, unfortunately. He didn't mention Mary Badham or Philip Alford. But Harlan, also not his only AFI film, did a lot of Westerns. As a lot of the technical people I'm about to mention did Westerns primarily. Red River and Rio Bravo being two big names. Neither one of those are AFI films. And they both were probably, well, Rio Bravo wasn't even nominated, come to think of it. Red River probably was somewhere in the shortlist. The editor, Aaron Stell, only AFI film, also did Touch of Evil and the Westerns. The composer, one of the more famous names, and we're only going to talk about him this one time on the project, despite some big titles I'll mention in a second, but that's Elmer Bernstein. And his credits include The Ten Commandments, Sweet Smell of Success, Magnificent Seven, HUD, The Great Escape, True Grit, Ghostbusters, and, we said it earlier, Far From Heaven.
Wow.
And many of those were nominated for Oscars, but none of them are AFI films.
I will say, I did not like this soundtrack. In this film.
Really, despite the fact it was more subtle than we've usually had on these
lists. I don't
know.
I disagree. I think there was some overkill.
Okay.
There was some, are you ready to feel this moment?
Well, interesting you say that because John Williams, who we're going to talk about so much in the 70s and 80s with the Spielberg movies and Star Wars, played piano.
No kidding.
He wasn't yet a composer, but he was involved.
Maybe that's why I don't like it.
You know, he's still making music. I mean, we'll know when John Williams dies. He's so famous. But he's something like 82, and he's still writing music. He'll be writing for whatever Spielberg makes until he dies, probably. The other technicians I got to mention are the Oscar-winning set designers, and that would be Henry Bumstead. We talked about him with Hitchcock films. We're going to talk about him when we get to Unforgiven, because he worked a lot with Eastwood. Bummy, Alexander Glitzen, and Oliver Umert did the sets that they recreated on stage. A lot of it was a backlot, just looking like an authentic Alabama-type town.
Mm-hmm.
They did a pretty good job. I didn't look to see if the movie was in any way on location. It must have been in some places.
I love the interior sets. Those really show tons of great detail.
And one of those great detailed sets would be the courtroom, which is pretty small, but probably pretty believable. And that scene is homaged in Pleasantville, because in that movie, at the trial near the end of the film, the coloreds, meaning the people who are actually in color, I love that movie so much, as it plays out and people, when they finally become human, actually are not black and white anymore, they're in the upper level, but the whites, or the black and whites, I guess you could say, are on the lower level. And then I guess the other big influence I definitely want to mention would be Cameron Crowe. Crowe's been influenced by Wilder. We talked about that in his recent films. And he certainly loved this one, too. It's one of his favorite movies. And he actually has it in the beginning of Almost Famous. In the opening, when William Milner's mother came out of the movies, they had gone to see To Kill a Mockingbird. And they're discussing Atticus Finch and the morality of the movie. And that was one way to homage it. And also, the beginning of Almost Famous and To Kill a Mockingbird, you're seeing childhood items. Camera shot above what could be a desk, you could argue. In Almost Famous, it's showing all the things that William Milner would have accumulated on the road, being a rock critic. And To Kill a Mockingbird, of course, it's the various items, including a lot of things that Boo had left for the kids, the soaps, sculptures, and the various other things. And then Crowe also homaged Atticus himself with the Kurt Russell character in Vanilla Sky. They show that, you know, spoiler alert for Vanilla Sky, that towards the end of the movie when they are addressing what Tom Cruise's brain has been going through, his characters look up to Atticus. So when he creates the Kurt Russell character, that's why he looks and dresses a lot like Atticus Finch and gives him good counsel like Atticus would. All right, an extensive list of awards and AFI lists here. So the three Oscars it won for Peck as Best Actor, Horton Foote's script, and the sets I just mentioned, those fellas. Five nominations that it didn't win, Best Picture, Director for Mulligan, Supporting Actress for Badham, the cinematography, and the score by Bernstein that you didn't like.
Nope.
The film, despite its legendary popularity, it took 6 years to make the National Film Registry, but it did in 1995. And then here's some impressive numbers. 17th from the top 25 music scores. I don't agree with that, actually. If you're going to only pick 25 movies to honor him, why it wasn't 50 or 100, I don't know. I wouldn't put it on my top 25 either. But how about this? Second, top 100 cheers. Mm-hmm. Number one was It's Wonderful Life. Jimmy Stewart, of course, played that character. It could have been the top two films. And number one in the courtroom category in the top 100 genres. I mentioned some of those other films that made that list when I talked about courtroom summation speeches.
Mm-hmm.
And the final AFI acclamation would be Atticus Finch was, probably not surprisingly, the number one hero on the heroes and villains list. I don't know if I would have put him number one, but I do respect that.
Yeah.
But interesting that he's a lawyer, and he's the number one hero. But then again, number two to four are a grave robber, a murdering spy, and a whiskey peddler. So, and those three are Indiana Jones, James Bond, and Rick Blaine in Casablanca. All right, this is the first time since we started doing trivia. I didn't ask you any during the podcast, so just a couple quick ones before we wrap. Dill is not from Alabama. Where is he from?
Louisiana?
Mississippi. And what is Boo Radley's real first name?
I can't remember.
Arthur.
Damn.
Arthur and Jean Louise. Boo and
Fail.
Scout.
Fail.
All right, that's enough random trivia. There'll be more on the website. So, final thoughts.
Okay, so it's definitely a two perfect film. Like, it indulges too much in its idealism, and that can drive me crazy, as was evident with Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. But for some reason, it really works for me, and I would keep it on my long list of Hollywood's greatest films. Number 25 is definitely generous, but as we've pointed out many times before, the AFI is a nearly irrational love for idealism. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if the love of this film is at least 50% just the love of the character of Atticus Finch. You wish he was your dad, and you wish you were him. He's the perfect cipher for all liberal idealism.
And that's why I didn't want to play him, because I don't like that stuff. Now, I think you're right about that. That has got to be a huge part of it. It's also, you relate to when you were a kid.
Yeah.
You were Scout, you were Jem, especially Scout. She is the main character, really, despite the supporting actress.
And like I said, for girls, there really isn't a lot of films that have a perspective of a little girl. It's not really something you see very often.
So many of these movies are dude movies, period.
We're lucky lately to have a woman in the film at all. So
that's true. It's
let alone be the main character in any way.
But no, I think you hit on something with Atticus being such a draw, because he's well played, he's well written, despite his Jesus-ness, but he's also the ideal person. And I guess
and
that's
they,
why they picked him as their top hero.
They really pull it off. That's something that separates this film from other films like it. And I can't exactly figure out what the formula is. I know a lot of it is his performance. A lot of it is just the depth of the character to begin with. But it's a good film.
And you're a big fan of the book, too.
Yeah,
right?
I love the book.
I've never read the book, but okay. So before we go, a quick recap of 1962 films, because we did see three of them. And this is the last one. Manchurian Candidate was first. We loved that. Lawrence of Arabia, we respected that. And Now to Kill a Mockingbird, which is kind of in the middle of that. There's love of elements of it. Hey, any movie that can nearly make me break down and didn't have to prepare myself so I won't break down, it's got to have something going for it. And if I didn't make it clear, I certainly respect this movie an awful lot, too. I wouldn't put it top 25 either, but I can see why people love it so much. I also didn't dislike it the way I kind of did before. I guess it's fair to say I actually didn't
like
it that much. I've come around
to it more.
I've tended to do that most of these films. I've liked some of them less, but generally the ones I didn't like the first time, I either see the virtues in them or I just flat out like them regardless of virtues or anything else. So I guess the obvious question and the easy answer is, what's your favorite of these three? And I think I know what the answer to that is.
Oh, yeah, that's easy. Manchurian Candidate.
And
no
film
contest.
And that's the only film you'd seen before.
Yeah.
But it still felt fresh and new to you.
Oh, God, it's so great. Yeah.
But what a diverse threesome.
And I think we're seeing modernism creep into films. Modernism probably isn't the right word, but in the 60s, you can see things changing. The seed was there in the 50s, but now you can feel them kind of shaking off those shackles of Hollywood, and they're getting less square, and they're just kind of getting more creative and free, setting up for what will be the explosion of creativity in the late 60s and 70s.
And it's interesting that we're in this stretch right now where we haven't had any of the actors who are given so much credit for bringing that style. Just coincidentally, they haven't made movies that made the AFI list when you go chronologically, but no Brando for a while now. We haven't done Newman yet. We're only going to do him once anyway. We haven't had Clifton in a long time. We haven't had Jimmy Dean in a long time. Mm-hmm. All these guys are credited with that kind of realistic acting. Women in the same boat. We've had foreign actors like Peter O'Toole last week and now Peck, and the only time he was in, but he's also old school Hollywood. He was born in 1918 or something, so he's certainly not a modern actor. But you're right, it's funny how that happened, where the movies have been influenced by the method, by this new style of making movies, by both acting and directing and everything
else. By the weakening of the morality codes as well.
And the studios are starting
to
fall.
A lot more.
One of the things we know we're going to talk about at the end of this decade of films that we're covering here in the 60s is the collapse of the studio era.
Yeah.
And that brought about what many people, including me, think is the greatest era in the history of film,
the
70s.
Yeah, thank God the studios collapsed. When you realize how much they were holding back Hollywood films, it's definitely a good thing that that changed.
Mm-hmm. All right, so To Kill a Mockingbird, somewhat reserved thumbs up, but definitely thumbs up all the same.
I think something I failed to mention is it is actually a pleasure to watch.
Yeah, it goes by very nicely.
Yeah,
it's a little over 2 hours. Doesn't
feel
too long, though.
The very ending, more of my biggest problems, but up until that point, up until the trial ends, it's really entertaining. It's fun. It engages you a lot.
I did say that it doesn't feel too long. It does have pacing problems.
You forgive the pacing problems because the characters and the actors are really just a joy to watch.
I guess that's what it is. Yeah.
The writing and the particular scenes.
The subtle direction.
I think if the pacing of the story is problematic, they make up for it by being so charming.
All right, so that's To Kill a Mockingbird. Up next on the Top 100 Project is one of our favorites, another black and white film, our third in 4 weeks. And it's the return of Stanley Kubrick with his hilarious Dr. Strangelove.
Yes, Jack, yes.
Impressions will be flying fast and furious.
Oh, man. We're going to be the most annoying podcasters ever.
We said many months ago on some other film, this may be our longest podcast, so we've been breaking pretty close to an hour lately. This one's maybe going to clear an hour when it's all said and done. Wouldn't surprise me.
This is one of our favorite films. You're like, most couples have a song. This is like our film.
Yeah. And maybe we'll explain that during the podcast, or maybe we won't, because maybe it doesn't belong to you to know why.
Makes
So the coming attractions trivia for Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Peter Sellers plays three roles. Name the other AFI movie with starring cast members playing multiple roles in the same movie, not including people in disguise like Vertigo or Tootsie or Some Like It Hot.
It's like playing like actual different characters. Yep. Oh, I'm going to have to think about that. That's a good question. All right, so for the answer to that question, please tune in next week to our Dr. Strangelove podcast. In the meantime, if you'd like more trivia from Ryan and me and lots of other fun stuff, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. And we'd love to hear what you have to say about To Kill a Mockingbird and any other movie that we've covered on the project. Please send us a message. We'd love to hear from you. top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And we'd like to once again thank our sponsor, sparkplug.coffee.
Miss Bev, stand up. Your dog's panting.
And cut.